I always say, good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. I'm going to say good evening because I feel like it.
All right.
Okay.
even though it's morning.
Right. We're back in New Orleans, Louisiana, dear NOLA. Every time we think that we've eaten in all the restaurants in New Orleans, there's a new one or two opening up or a new chef. But then there's history too.
Yeah,
such a good time.
Yeah, and today's about new action. Next week's mostly about old action. Yeah, there's a little bit of old time stuff at the end of this program as well, but leading off the program, three not new chefs, but three chefs in new places.
Well, you know, I adore Ryan Pruitt. You know that.
Yeah, I do.
I know. And his restaurant, Pesh, I mean, not one, but two.
James Beard
Awards.
Exactly. Wow. And we had an adventure there, too. So you'll have to hang on to hear about what that's about.
Did we talk about it?
Is Ryan up first?
Yes.
Yeah, I think we did talk about it. I think I said something like, Pesh is setting the house on fire.
Setting the world on fire, right.
Setting the world on fire, and it turned out it was their restaurant. But Ryan was as calm as ever, as you can tell from our conversation. I think we'd better get this interview out of the way before the crowd gets so loud that we can't be heard. But seriously, folks, Ryan Pruitt and his restaurant, Pesh, are setting the world on fire. That's kind of an inside joke. But if I tell you that, as a reminder, they just won not one but two James Beard Awards, you'll get an idea of what we're talking about. So we just absolutely had to come to New Orleans and had to come to Pesh. And here we are, along with half the rest of the population of Louisiana and people scattered from all the other states as well. Welcome, first of all, Ryan, welcome to On the Menu.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
Well, that doesn't give you much of a question to answer. So let's explain. This restaurant, Pesh, is new because it won best new in the whole entire country for the James Beard Awards. And it's really spelled Pesh as in the French. And it's part of the Donald Link Group. Tell us about the ownership partnership.
Sure. So Donald and Steven Strajewski from Koshan and I are the three owners of the restaurant. You know, we sort of went into the restaurant together and developed the idea over many years of traveling and sort of trying to decide what we wanted to do. We knew that we wanted to do another restaurant in New Orleans. We knew that we wanted to, after traveling, incorporate live fire cooking into the restaurant. We knew that we wanted to have all of these elements of wood and fire and smoke and coals. And then we also knew that we wanted to do a seafood restaurant. And so really the two just sort of merged together, and Pesh is the result.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is a trend. You're either cooking things sous vide and doing little scientific tricks, or chefs are playing with fire. Why is this so magical an attraction now?
I think many chefs are drawn to fire because of its elemental simplicity. It's a very elemental way of cooking. It's very comforting. You're cooking with a live fuel source. It's interactive. You're not cooking with knobs. You're not cooking with a thermostat on an oven. You're doing many more things by feel, and I think your chefs, by their very nature, are interested in feel. Everything is by touch. You know, the doneness of a steak, the cookedness, is that a word? Of fish, things, visual cues, tactile cues are all involved. And I think the fire plays into that. You think for us and for many other people as well, there's also the aspect that it just makes things taste good. A little smoke on something, the cooking medium that a bed of wood coals can provide, is both unique and delicious.
Now, I made the mistake because of something I read, which was a misstatement, that you were lured here from California. That wasn't wholly untrue, but the real truth of the matter is you are, in fact, born and bred a Southern boy.
It's true. I was born and raised in Memphis and only lived in California for about 7 years. But it was a very influential time. It's when I started cooking professionally. It's through the people I was working with in California that I ended up hearing Donald's name and subsequently coming to New Orleans and asking him for a job, which he thankfully gave to me. So the time in California was very important, but most of my background is as a Southern bred individual.
Now, I asked about the Pesh because the information I read about the restaurant is that you did your research, particularly in the open fire cooking and the grills and so forth. You did your research in Spain and was Uruguay, but the name is French.
Right. So the name speaks more to our location, to where we are. We are a sister restaurant of Cochon. We thought we'd sort of continue that trend. Naming a restaurant is very hard. Coming up with the menu was much easier than naming the restaurant. I think for Donald, Steven, and I, the food part came a lot more naturally. Naming the restaurant was just very difficult. You can imagine if three people are trying to name a child, it's tough. And through many sort of myriad versions of the name, we ended up on Pesh because we felt like it was simple, straightforward, and it sort of spoke to what we were doing and where we were. As for our time spent in Uruguay and Spain, those trips really, particularly Uruguay, but heavily influenced the style of cooking that we're using here. And that's not to say we're serving anything South American or particularly Spanish. The food is very much of Louisiana. The methods and the cooking techniques we saw when we were in Uruguay and in Spain is what we chose to import to the restaurant.
For those who are not as fortunate as we are, since we are here and they are not, give us a brief rundown on the concept of the ambience and decor of this place.
Sure. So this, where we're sitting right now is a large, open, former warehousey type space, in the warehouse district of New Orleans. This part of the building dates to 1850. The part, where the bar is dates to 1870. It's got a very colorful history. We have a long, wall of windows that were formerly barn doors. The first, version of this building, it was a carriage stable. So this was a horse yard, barns, right here. And then it became a mortuary. We had supposedly Jefferson Davis was embalmed here, but I've heard other people claim that too, and I have no definitive proof, but till proven wrong, I'll keep saying it, I suppose. And then it was, the French Market Coffee Company, and they roasted coffee here for quite some time until they ended up moving, to the east of here. But when we approached the owner, this whole space was a dirt floor, and we saw great potential in the open brick and the old wood, and it had a lot of elements that really spoke to us.
You know, I mean, I didn't realize this old wood actually is original, because most people starting out building a restaurant today buy old wood and put it in, but this is original.
Right. This, the beams that support the ceiling, there's a few that you can tell have been replaced over the years, but most of them are original to the building. The ceiling is covered in, old, pine, that was the flooring for the above stories. So this is 100-year-old pine that we remilled and then used for the ceiling. The doors, which are about 13 feet high, were original to that part of the building as well, and we had them remilled and reworked.
I also love the way you moved the dirt floor outside.
Yeah, they've been under construction here for a full year, as I understand it. Hopefully that'll pass. Who comes here?
Well, a lot of different people come here, and that was one of the ideas behind the restaurant. We wanted people to feel equally as comfortable in shorts and a t-shirt for lunch as they would in a suit for dinner. And, you know, we strive to create a menu and an atmosphere that is professionally comfortable, but still remains casual. We're certainly not a fine dining restaurant. We're not trying to be a fine dining restaurant. But at the same time, we do have a lot of tables that come in and want a more full longer dining experience, and we can certainly provide that as well. We have three different sections of the restaurant. We have a bar. We have a bar, which, you know, caters to it. We take no reservations for the bar or the oyster bar. So we save that for walk-ins. There's a lot of neighborhood people that eat at these two locations. Tends to be single diners, you know, people that may live around here that are coming down. And then we have a fairly spacious dining room that seat, I think we've got about 120 seats in the dining room, so it's fairly large.
You did reference your menu, so I think maybe we ought to talk a little bit about what kind of food you do here. I mean, I see New Orleans, I see Louisiana, Gulf Coast, every place in the ingredients of your restaurant.
Yes, and that kind of speaks to the mantra of the restaurant. We wanted to present the fish, the seafood of the Gulf Coast. We wanted to really work with that product and maybe give it just a slightly different treatment. You know, there's a lot of things on here. We're certainly not inventing anything here, but we're approaching Gulf seafood in sort of the way that we really wanted to, the way that dishes we've had in the past, ways that we've had fish and seafood that we've enjoyed, that we wanted to present to New Orleans. We sort of thought about how we wanted to position the restaurant and what we wanted to do, and we weren't going to be a white tablecloth restaurant, so there wasn't going to be sort of those type of presentations. We weren't going to fry any, you know, be a fried seafood restaurant, because there's plenty of people that do that well already. We're not going to be a boiled seafood restaurant, because again, there's plenty of people that do that very well already. We really just wanted to present Gulf seafood, maybe in a little bit different, slightly fresher light.
Let's do food porn. Walk us through some of the specific dishes we're going to be eating.
Well, one of the dishes that's we've become known for is a whole grilled redfish. And the whole grilled fish is a piece of the menu that we take a lot of pride in, and it's something that we've surprisingly been fairly successful in selling. I was a little worried in the beginning that people weren't going to enjoy eating whole fish on the bone. We don't carve the fish. We just clean it up and grill it. And surprisingly, people really have taken to it. And it's very heartwarming to see families in the restaurant all sharing a meal together and sharing a fish together. And so the whole fish has really become, in many ways, emblematic of what we're doing here. The red fish is a standard. We always have it on the menu. And then we tend to bounce around. We'll get speckled trout in. We'll get snappers, various other fish that come from our region. So that one's kind of become a standard bearer for the menu. We always have a tuna dish on the menu. We typically grill the tuna. Tonight we serve it with grilled greens and an olive salad. You know, tuna is one of the fish that's it's everywhere in the Gulf. It's a very sort of defining fish for the Gulf of Mexico. We use it in a lot of places. We break down all of our own tuna from whole. So, you know, right now we're going through about 300 plus pound tuna a week. It varies. This is kind of the busiest we've been, so that's probably the high point. But it's allowed us to do something that we really wanted to get to, which was fabricating the tunas in-house, fabricating whole wahoo and swordfish in-house, and offering different cuts of the fish. So we can offer the bellies. We can grill the heads, which are just fantastic off these large fish. We can grill the collars. We can take all of the loins and fabricate them such that we can put some in the raw bar. We can send some to the grill. And then the pieces that may be a little sinewy or sort of hard to eat in just a grilled preparation, we're able to cure and then smoke. And we'll make dips or sandwiches and things like that out of that. So we're really able to bring in these whole fish, you know, straight off the boat and utilize them fully. And that's really opened up a lot of pathways for us and allows us to serve some stuff that's a little bit different.
I see you've got the ever-trendy cauliflower on the menu. We interviewed at Pizza Domenica with Alon Shaya. He says they go through 700 of them a week. I'm 400, Peter corrects me. It's still a lot of cauliflowers. I know this is a dumb question in a way, but I'm just curious myself. Who or what influenced you the most in your cooking style?
that's a great question and a little complicated, but to simplify, I think there's a few things that play into to most people's cooking style and definitely mine. There's firstly, it's where you are. And so, you know, we're here, we're in South Louisiana. We have a palette of fruits and vegetables and fish and animals to work with. And first, I think that colors, you know, your creativity as a cook. You know, second, you're always burdened by your history, whether you like it or not. So my history is, as a Memphian, as growing up a Southerner, I came from the family I came from, and we did the things we did, and that plays a big part in it. Moved to California, cooked out there with the vegetables out there, really just fell in love with the whole world of cooking in California, and California has such amazing produce. It was not hard to do. And then finally, all cooks are guided by their past jobs, their mentors in the industry. For me, Donald Link's a big mentor, and all of these things kind of come to play, you know, in every decision that I make when I'm in the kitchen.
Well, and I know chefs who have been nominated and finalists in the Beard Awards 5, 6, 7 times. You got to put into some kind of word what it was like for you, first time out of the box here, winning 2 James Beard Awards. What did you think? Even I don't understand how that's possible, just right out of the box.
Well, I suppose I didn't really know what to think. I mean, it was just the whole experience was so incredible. It's so humbling. And to be on the stage once is an achievement that many chefs strive for their whole career, and I know it's been in the back of my mind, but to be twice in one night was just, I still don't even really know what to think. I mean, it's just kind of incredible. And I think the Beard Awards are very important because they're a peer chosen award. And so you're being judged by your contemporaries, and to know that my contemporaries enjoy what we're doing to some degree and like what the path that we're going down is certainly, you know, it's a great honor, at the very least.
Well, I'm totally enthralled with your success so far, and I certainly hope you continue along with it. Congratulations.
And we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. It's a good thing I love octopus, because that seemed to be on every menu, and I do love it, and I enjoyed it.
And don't you just?
I just exactly do.
They must catch a lot of octopus in New Orleans, because it was everywhere on a lot of menus.
Yeah, I never think of New Orleans as octopus, but it really was.
And Chef Brian Landry certainly knows
good
how
old
to,
southern name.
Certainly knows how to fix it. And
restaurant born. I thought that meant something really deeply intellectual, but it's named after a lake, which in turn is named One-Eyed.
Yeah, we never did get a good explanation of why it was called One-Eye, but it is a place where Brian and his partner, Chef John Besh, both used to fish when they were children. And so it's not surprising that there's a seafood focus on this restaurant's menu, and it's seafood of the day, and it's seafood that's really special.
And we loved it.
We did.
Yes.
Okay, so let's go with Brian Landry, chef partner at Bourne Restaurant. It's in a hotel just off Poydras Street in the Central Business District of New Orleans, just in case you're trying to find where it is.
I love New Orleans. Everybody who's ever listened to us knows that. And the fun thing is, although this is certainly not even by close chance the first time we've ever been to New Orleans, every time we come, there is a new restaurant and a new chef we get to meet and talk to. Tonight, we're at Bourne, which I understand means one eye, which I think that Chef Brian Landry will explain to us in French, which is a seafood restaurant. Brian, welcome to On the Menu. And let's start with, what does this mean, this one-eye thing?
Well, Bourne is the name of a lake that connects Lake Pontchartrain to the Gulf of Mexico. due to coastal erosion, it's more of a saltwater estuary. But Lake Bourne is actually where myself and Chef Besh grew up fishing and catching blue crabs. And it's still today where we get a lot of our seafood from. And so in honor of all the seafood that we have caught ourselves and that we harvest from Lake Bourne, we thought it would be a great idea to open a restaurant that celebrated all the fresh seafood coming out of the Gulf of Mexico. And we did that with a restaurant we called Bourne.
So you've known John Besh for a long time, and he shares the same kinds of traditions. But you actually, although you said you've cooked since you were 14 or something, I don't want to ask how old you are now, because you still look pretty young to me. But anyhow, you actually went to Johnson & Wales in Charleston, South Carolina, which is, of course, another fantastic food city. You come to this job really well prepared, and after having sampled a couple of your dishes, I mean, you got it.
Well, thank you. I do. I have the privilege of growing up cooking in some of the most wonderful restaurants this city has to offer. I did, after cooking for a short while, move to Charleston and receive my culinary degree at Johnson & Wales, and then quickly moved back and worked for another round of great chefs, including Kevin Vizard and Rene Bajou, Gerard Morris, and now partnered up with Chef Besh. I did do a nice six-year stint at Galatoire's, which is one of the Creole grand dames of the city, and learned a ton there. But very happy to be at Bourne now.
Just an aside, has there been a renaissance of Galatoire's?
Galatoire's is still doing great. They actually have expanded their business. They opened a steakhouse next door. I'm still very close friends with all of them over there.
Now, it certainly makes sense for you to be in a seafood restaurant in New Orleans. You missed out one stage of your career where you actually promoted the whole seafood industry here.
Yes, for a brief stint in between Galatoire's and opening Bourne, it was right after the BP oil spill in the Gulf. I took a job with the Louisiana Seafood Marketing Board and traveled around the country preparing wild-caught Gulf seafood so people could see and taste that our seafood was still as delicious and safe as ever.
And it certainly is. Another aside, BP's never paid up, have they?
I think that's still a work in progress.
I asked you this before we started recording, actually, and I was interested in your answer. Everybody's really involved today in the food industry with the sustainability of seafood, and yet you have such iconic standard seafood dishes here. You've got the crawdaddies, you've got oysters, you've got shrimp. How do you balance what is locavore to you, because it's local, with what the sustainability issues of the oceans are today?
So at Bourne, we're very much blessed into as to what seafoods we are offered on a daily basis. And for a long time, Louisiana has actually done a very good job of tracing their seafood all the way from the water to the plate. And so after major events like hurricanes, oil spills, it was actually fairly easy for us to track all of our seafood and the waters from which it was coming from.
I can't understand why, if you can do that in New Orleans, the whole world is trying to do that, and the whole country is trying to do that. Why can't they, and why can you?
I think there's always a lot of competing forces, politics, money, that drive different decision-making processes. In Louisiana, we use a trip ticket system, which allows us to track all of our seafood. But then as a restaurateur, I also have to make decisions on a daily basis as to what type of fish I want to add to my menu, what's in season, what fish are available to us. And so we always offer a very wide variety of different fish that offer our customers different textures, different flavor profiles. And lots of times we're just letting Mother Nature dictate to us what we can offer to our customers. So just like produce follows a season, in New Orleans we definitely let our seafood dictate the season as well.
Now, you were talking about the different influences in the cuisine of New Orleans, and you mentioned a couple of things that we were really curious about. Tell us a little bit about the Spanish influence, because it's seen on your menu here.
Yeah, so one of the great things about partnering with someone like Chef Besh is you really get to use them as a great sounding board. And we really get to dive into the history of the food. And so most of the restaurants that both myself and John came up cooking in New Orleans and around New Orleans were very French-driven Creole restaurants. But there's this very vibrant community who settled around Lake Bourne called the Isleños, which means islander. And when Spain originally wanted to settle what is now the city of New Orleans to defend against British invasion, they basically conscribed people from the Canary Islands to come and settle the New World on their behalf. And so there's this very vibrant community called the Isleños, and they are responsible for the Spanish influence on our cuisine. And so the further we dive into kind of the history of where Creole cuisine comes from, I was able to learn a lot about what specific Spanish influences there are on Creole cuisine. And then I actually went to the Canary Islands before we opened Bourne and lived there for a month and cooked in people's homes and in restaurants and toured wineries and farms. And it got me a lot closer to where that Spanish influence came from.
Now, Canary Islands, I never even knew they were known for food. I mean, I always saw that people peddling souvenirs in boats, but anyhow, that's another thing altogether. You have all this wonderful product available. Like, in your seafood, is it all natural, wild, or do you also have a lot of farming industry here?
So when it comes to things like fin fish, we're basically only serving wild-caught Gulf fin fish. Other products like oysters and crawfish, you could consider them farmed. I mean, oysters, you know, beds are laid, and a lot of our oysters are coming straight through P&J Oyster Company, which is a 140-year-old local oyster company. But crawfish are definitely the majority of the crawfish we buy are what you would call farm, but there's these big rice plantations basically that can double as both rice and crawfish. But when it comes to like blue crabs, those are always all wild caught. The majority of what we are serving is all considered wild caught Gulf seafood.
I remember somebody a long time ago talking to me about paddlefish roe, where they got the roe from paddlefish in New Orleans and then had to send it to Washington State or someplace. What was that about?
Well, there are quite a few fish locally that produce caviar for us. And so one of the ones we love to use is shoepick. And we use a lot of caviar through Louisiana Caviar Company and John Burke. And he also makes one that I absolutely adore called, it's a ghost pepper infused caviar. And it's not too spicy, but it just adds just nice little zing that you would lots of times associate with Cajun or Creole food.
Which brings us back to our other discussion is you are an ingredient driven chef. And you do the surprising maestro touches, as you just described with this, the caviar, with the ghost chili. Talk to us about, first of all, let's talk about, you also have bar experience, and I don't mean by drinking, but I mean by making it up. And I just had one of your cocktails, and it was wonderful, because I don't like cocktails generally. Talk to us a little bit about your cocktail menu.
So coming up in restaurants, most cooks will tell you it's very hard to make a lucrative living as you're coming up as a cook in a professional kitchen. And so for a long time, I worked in both the front of the house and back of the house. And so I do have a lot of bartending experience, and so I write the cocktail menu here at Bourne. And I like my cocktails a lot like the way I cook my food. I don't like to fuss over it too much. I like to let the liquors shine through and just use basically accents to highlight whatever it is that we're preparing that day. And so the drink you had, we call the Snapdragon, and it's a whiskey-based drink that we finish with just a little ginger syrup and a dry apple cider. But a lot of our cocktails are driven the same way. We don't fuss over them too much. We're a very large restaurant, so they kind of have to be built for a little bit of speed. But we make very delicious, rather simple cocktails.
Now, I had a Sazerac, which I always have when I come to New Orleans. And the reason I do that is because I'm authoritative. People have told me it was the original cocktail anyway. Several years ago, we met a very special lady who tended bar La Provence. Her name was Miss Joy. And Miss Joy produced the definitive Sazerac. She told me that. So just to prove that I was a man, I had two. And I don't think I was driving that day. If I was, I don't remember. And she's still out there?
The Besh Group as a whole has some great mixologists and great bartenders who tell great stories, just like all good bartenders should.
Now we talk about food here. We already had one of the most interesting gazpachos, yellow gazpachos I've ever had with blue crab. How could that go wrong? And we had the broiled oysters. Tell us a little bit. Walk us through some of the recipes. I'm going to ask you to do that with the menu.
So the two dishes you had, the yellow tomato gazpacho, rather simple gazpacho. We get these great yellow tomatoes from a farm right north of us, just about an hour and 15 minutes north of New Orleans, called Covey Rise. And they bring us our produce a couple of times a week. And they're bringing us whatever's harvested fresh right there. They grow phenomenal tomatoes. This year alone, they've planted about 40 different varieties. And so we'll have everything from purples and reds and greens and oranges and all different color tomatoes. But they grow some great yellow tomatoes for us. So we make a simple gazpacho that we finish with dandelion vinegar, which adds just a hint of sweetness to it. And then we make a nice, fresh blue crab salad with green and purple basil.
See, listeners, this is what I mean. He's doing everything very straightforward, except he sneaks in all these master touches. Aha! So that was it. Now, what about these broiled Louisiana oysters?
And so the oysters, we definitely lean towards that Spanish influence that I was mentioning earlier. We do use a good amount of a mix of olive oil and garlic, and then we use smoked paprika and dried red chili flakes. And so you just get a little bit of spice. We like to say that our food's seasoned well, not necessarily spicy, but you get that wonderful garlic flavor and a little bit of heat.
The secret here is that everything's so perfectly balanced. I mean, this is really seasoning, acidity. These are the things that I call genius. What about some other things in your menu? I know I'm getting soft-shell crabs, but tell us some other dishes.
So the food is supposed to remind you of, it's a little, I guess we'd call it elevated fishing camp style cuisine. And so it's dishes that are very familiar to people who are recreational fishermen in Louisiana and hunters as well. And so one of our most popular appetizers is actually not a seafood dish. We call it duck poppers. And the same thing, we source our duck from Chappapila Farms, which is right north of us as well. And we sear that with a little Creole seasoning. We wrap a pickled jalapeno in the duck and then wrap that in bacon and grill it all off so the duck's nice and medium rare. And we finish that with a Steen's cane syrup gastrique and a little herbed cream cheese. And we just can't keep him in the house. And that's something that it's got a riff on a dish that all local duck hunters know how to make. And then we move on to things. One of my favorite personal dishes is the fish in the bag, which is, it's a fish and papillote, but we don't like to make it too fancy. And the fish changes seasonally as well. So lately we've used everything from sheep's head to barjack, which is like a small amberjack, dorada or mahi. And we use whatever the fishermen are bringing to us. One of my favorites we've also had recently is a barrel grouper, which is a deep water grouper. And so the fish itself steams in the bag, and we to accompany it in the bag, we do a caramelized fennel and onion with some cardinal spinach that we get from Covey Rise as well, the red and yellow grape tomatoes, a little lemon zest, fresh tarragon, and then the one secret ingredient, we make a crab fat butter. And so we infuse butter with gumbo crabs and crab fat. So you get this really intense crab-flavored butter. One little pat of it's all you need, but it adds just that little something extra at the end.
I don't eat desserts, but I'm sure a lot of our listeners really want to know about it. And you seem to have a fairly serious lineup of richness here. How about talking about a few desserts?
So we are blessed to work with Chef Kelly Fields, who does the dessert program here at Bourne. And we approach our desserts in a lot of the same ways we approach the way we cook our savory food. My current favorite is modeled after one of my favorite cocktails, which is a Dark and Stormy. And so it is a icebox key lime pie that's topped with black rum ice cream and ginger foam with a little ginger snap crust. And it's wildly delicious. It's great for summer. And then our probably signature dessert, again, we'll nod towards the Spanish. It is a chocolate hazelnut pudding that we serve in a glass jar that has Gianduja chocolate, cocoa meringues, toasted hazelnuts, and that's topped with condensed milk sorbet.
Well, I'm really happy to have met you because, I mean, nobody knows this, but I have this little tab on my heart where I write the names of chefs that I'm really happy to know, and you're going on there. Oh, Brian, thank you so much, and it's been just a pleasure to meet you and to eat your food, and you have such thoughtful insights into the cooking of New Orleans. Thank you.
Thank y'all for coming by, and can't wait to cook again for you another time.
And we'll have another chef who's kicking up a storm cooking seafood right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, this next restaurant, I went there first when it first opened. Then you and I went.
Yep.
When it had settled in.
Yep.
But this third time, we had a totally different chef-owner situation.
Yep.
And, yeah, so, and it was a wine dinner, a specialty of the New Orleans wine and food experience. So it was a different setting altogether, too.
But we did find out a couple of very interesting things. Aside from Rio Mar itself, an interesting restaurant, the same two gentlemen own a restaurant called Little Gem, and we had Little Gem's ribs.
They were really good. I liked those.
During the Royal Street Stall the next day. A couple of the really intriguing things about Little Gem. First of all, it's an old-time New Orleans institution that Miles and his partner have taken over and restored. And the story goes that a 12-year-old Louis Armstrong was arrested one night for carrying on outside this restaurant called Little Gem. So instead of putting him in jail, they sent him to an orphanage and gave him a cornet. and the rest is history. What's going on with Rio Mar?
Sure, it wasn't a saxophone.
Rio Mar's having a branch. Rio Mar's going to have a child or a cousin or something like that. But Louis Armstrong played the trumpet. He didn't play the saxophone. Dope. Anyway, so he's going to open a new restaurant.
Clarinet or something, didn't you?
Cornet.
A cornet.
And that's what Miles called it. You could call it a trumpet, I guess. The intriguing thing is that he's about to launch a Nikkei Peruvian restaurant.
Right.
In New Orleans. And
we married a woman from Argentina.
Yeah, we talked just a little bit about that. And he was actually surprised that we knew what Nikkei was. He said, most people don't. So there you go. Every now and again, hanging around the food industry, you do pick up a thing or two. But anyway, here's Miles talking.
Miles Prescott.
Yeah, talking about Rio Mar and the wine program and what they were going to cook for us and all that good stuff.
Well, I can't remember when I first set foot into Rio Mar. I came with Gene Bourque, who used to be, he's retired now as the chief restaurant critic for New Orleans. And you were just recently opened, so that goes back a ways. We're talking now to Miles Prescott, who is the executive chef for I guess it's now a mini empire. I didn't realize that. Burgeoning empire. I say mini empire, and you say
burgeoning empire. We'll go with that. We'll say burgeoning for now.
Anyhow, it's classified Rio Mar as a seafood restaurant, Spanish seafood restaurant, but you're expanding in concept, and I'm going to talk about that in a few minutes. I want to find out where you are and who you are to start with. I mean, you've been in food practically since you were a toddler.
That's true, since I was 16. So this makes 20 years this year for me. So I started out in southern Georgia in a meat and three soul food restaurant, pretty far from New Orleans and pretty far from fine dining Latin American cuisine. But it's not, in the end, it turned out to not be that far of a stretch. I met my wife, she's in Argentina, about 8 years ago. And we have spent the last 8 years traveling extensively through South America, from Mexico to Argentina. We're in Buenos Aires at least once every 2 years. And while I'm there, when I have a moment of peace and I don't have 100 of my relatives around dragging me from one spot to another, then I'll just sit in the corner of her grandmother's kitchen and watch her turn out gnocchi or ensalada rusa or any number of different sausages. She makes it look so amazingly easy. So her name is Argentina because she was born on Independence Day in Argentina. So she's the most pure Argentine I know. But she's only one generation removed from Sicily on one side. And they just crank. The same with you? She can sit there and with hardly a motion and within a half an hour have a plate of gnocchi, a towering plate enough to feed the entire family on a Sunday afternoon on the long, luxurious lunches that we do there. So that's kind of where I got my feet into Latin cuisine first. Also, about 2005, I was the sous chef at a all-Catalan-style tapas restaurant in Chicago called Del Toro.
This is not really purely Spanish. As we're talking now, I realize, and as we spoke before, I realized you said it's Spanish in all the colonies, so that you're not really into a box here with the Spanish cuisine. Tell us how you differentiate this particular Rio Mar cuisine and your two other restaurants as well.
So Rio Mar is something that I inherited. It wasn't mine to create. It was created by Adolfo Garcia, at least the concept of it was. And Adolfo is Panamanian-born, raised in New Orleans, and then trained in Spain. And I think the original entity showed that, being that here it is with local cuisine here in New Orleans, or local food, local ingredients here in New Orleans. But at the same time, a lot of Spanish method, and the dishes themselves, like the zarzuela and the escabeche, these dishes were very reminiscent of what he learned when he was in Spain. Since it's become my restaurant, I've changed the menu. I've sort of directed it much more towards South America and Central America.
What other changes did you make to the old Rio Mar menu to make it really very personally yours?
When I took over, I moved the menu away from Spain in large part and into South America, especially Peru, Ecuador, Venezuela, and Colombia, and some Cuban stuff too. We really specialize now in ceviches, tiraditos, many different forms of fish presentation that are very healthy without the use of really the typical cooking methods. You know, we're using the ceviche method, which is cooking with citric acid typically. We've changed many of our dishes from things. So, for instance, zarzuela, our stew dishes, have become berihuelas. We're using a lot of the New World ingredients, say amaranth and quinoa. The chilies we're using now are all from the New World instead. We're the flavors, I think, dramatically over the older style, because that's more my story. That's more what I feel at home with, and that's the food that I would rather be presenting to people. And I think as time passed since 2000 and they opened Rio Mar, there's been plenty of new Spanish-style restaurants in town, Vega, Galvez, all these other styles. And still, Nuevo Latino, as far as the fine version of it, is lacking here. I think we really are the only one to do it, although Donald Link now has Pache, and maybe he's pushing that too. Who could say?
Pache is, I thought it was passion, it was French. It's Pache and it's Spanish? Pache,
yeah.
Oh, well, we're going there tomorrow, actually, yeah. Now, you intrigued me with something you said, but I think we need to complete this one concept. Is your second restaurant here is called Gem, and the third you're having is going to be a Nikkei. Explain those two.
Okay. Little Gem Saloon, once again, is another restaurant that I inherited. It was a different entity before I got there. It is a two-story, two-bar, two-stage live music venue with a full fine dining kitchen. And what we do there is what I call fine southern soul food. That's the best way to put it. So it's the traditional southern soul food done with a chef's eye for detail. Our fried chicken takes 3 days to get just right. Yeah, between the brine, and it has to be just right. The ribs, for instance, which is one of our signature dishes there, we have our own wood blend, our own spice rub. We make our own barbecue sauce, which is based on peaches. As you can tell, I'm from South Georgia, so based on peaches. And it's unique to the city, and perhaps it's unique everywhere, because the restaurant that I got the idea from when I was a kid, is no longer there, and that brings a tear to my eye when I think about that.
I hate to tell you, but actually South Carolina has surpassed Georgia in the production of peaches. But anyhow, that's neither here nor there. As I said, you're going to be opening in February a restaurant that combines, it fuses Japanese and Peruvian cuisine, which is why you're going back for another visit to Lima pretty soon, actually, July, I think you said. And that's going to be, as it's called, Nikkei, which would be a new thing for New Orleans, I'm sure. It's something that really got my attention is that you said that you may have all these versions, recipes, or whatever, relating to Central South America, Spanish colonies, foods, but you are so varied in techniques from all the exposure you've had from traveling that you use whatever technique and you vary it, mix it all up in all these foods, whatever works for you. Could you give me an example of that?
First, I'd like to go back and say that I've been doing quite a few interviews and mentioning the Nikkei concept to people, and I believe you were the first, when I said Nikkei, that didn't look at me with a blank sort of expression on their face. You actually know what it is, so that's reassuring. Maybe it's not quite so left field as I was afraid it might be for the town, but so method is something that when I think of a menu, when I come up with these dishes, it sort of begins with the final form that I want to see it in, the texture, the temperature, the spice level, the seasoning. From there, I'll work backward and figure out, say, for instance, there's a shrimp dish that we'll be serving tonight with a salsa mani. Salsa mani is a peanut sauce, basically. But the way we're going to go about it is far more Thai than it is Peruvian or Ecuadorian, which is really where that style is, what we're using it for, is coming from in this method. Because the result that we want to get to match the wine pairing, I think, plays better with that level of spice to acid to heat. So that's just an example.
Well, now you brought up another thing, is we're here, actually, covering and participating in the New Orleans wine and food experience, and we're here particularly at this restaurant because you have a special event, a special wine dinner tonight, and I'm looking at this menu. Explain a little bit about how you proceeded with the wine selections, and also just walk us through some of the special dishes we're going to have.
So Rio Mar paired up with Lorette, which is an importing company, and they paired us with a man named Jose Pastor, who lives and works in Spain as a wine maker and importer. What he did for us was to select 5 wines that are very rare, that are hard to find in the U.S. still so far, that he's particularly proud of and really wants to showcase. And these are things that, for one reason or another, are quite special in the wine selection that we can find. So some for instances. The first wine is a sparkling Muscatel. It's a semi-sweet from Valencia. And when you think of sparkling Moscato, you're thinking Italy usually. This one has an entirely different palate. It still has that amazing floral nose, and for a sparkling wine, a stunning nose. None of the yeast that you might expect. But the body isn't that viscous sort of heavy, sweet Moscato that you might think of from Italy. Something entirely different is coming out of Valencia. On the third course, we have a very interesting white wine that's actually made in the Canary Islands. And the result of it, I think, is reminiscent in some ways of a Chacolí, being that it seems to have some element of the seashore going to it. A good Chacolí almost has a flavor of the ocean just kind of waiting there underneath the effervescence for some seafood to pull out of it. And this, too, has that same sort of brininess almost going on in the background that needs to be pulled out. But the supporting characters, we'll say, of the wine are dramatically different than a typical Chacolí. So, again, nothing like you would normally find. The two red wines that he's bringing in, one from Navarra and one from the Riviera Sacra, are, in their own right, are just remarkable for the way that they're done. The Tempranillo for the fourth course is half carbonic maceration, which creates this strong cranberry flavor that you just would not expect from a Tempranillo. Anyway, all the wines we're just really proud to be able to pair up with. And it gives us a chance to do dishes that are surprising, I would say, but still in a way reminiscent of taking a trip around Spain and stopping at some little tapas bar to get a glass of wine and a couple of snacks to go with it.
I just couldn't help but interject because we went to a major Wines of Navarra thing in New York. I don't know, it's tasting, I guess. And do you know that more than 50% of the winemakers in that region are women?
I was not aware of that. I could not say that I was aware of that. And I could not speak to the gender of any of the winemakers here either. But nonetheless, I just would like to talk to about a couple of the dishes that we're going to pull up too, if I may. The first dish I passed off to my chef de cuisine here, Octavio Icaza, and I said, I want something with pork belly and green apples. Let's see what you can do. And that's going to be paired with the sparkling Muscatel. He came back with green apple marshmallows that he made in-house. And yeah, exactly. That's the face you're making. I think everyone else is making, too, out there. So the marshmallow and the skewers of pork belly are then charred as if maybe like a s'more. The flavor is remarkable, and the texture is a little absurd. I mean, it's wonderful. It's not in any way unpleasant, but it's definitely nothing like anything I've ever had before. So I love to be able to pass dishes off to people and see what they can come up with, especially when they come up with something that remarkable. So we start off with the most, I think, left-field, strangest thing that we're going to offer, and we play back kind of like every single wine that you get is from a different restaurant. Every single pairing you get is from a different restaurant. So the first restaurant would be the most dramatically different. Say, perhaps we started in Valencia and at one of the molecular gastronomy restaurants. And as we move to other parts in town, in other parts of Spain, you're going to find there some more traditional dishes too. For instance, there is one where there's a salsa maní. There's one where there's a paella. So we are doing some dishes that are fairly like standard in places and just doing them to the best of our ability. In other places, we're really pushing the envelope. One of my other favorite dishes tonight is going to be little neck clams that are stewed in red wine with chorizo and a tempranillo broth. Now, doesn't sound any too remarkable yet, and I'd like to leave a little mystery for you in there. But that's based on a fairly traditional one that I've had when I was in Spain before, where it was morcilla and red wine and clams, and I loved. But I think you'll find this dish to be pretty remarkable when you get it too.
You sure sound like you're having a lot of fun. Let's just get, because everybody I'm sure is just drooling and trying to figure out how they can get here. Let's give them a little information about where this is located, because it could be tricky finding it, right? And a website.
Our website is riomarseafood.com, And you can find us in the Warehouse District. We've been at the corner of Julia and South Peters now for 14 years. 14 years as of August. So we got a couple months left to get there. Yeah, so Julia and South Peters. Our phone number is 504-525-FISH. That's 3474. Little Gem Saloon is at the corner of Poydras and South Rampart. That's 445 South Rampart. The website is www.littlegemsaloon.com. And just a little backstory on that, Little Gem and the Eagle Saloon were the two original jazz clubs of New Orleans. Both opened in 1903, and they bookend the same block. Unfortunately, no one has gotten around to restoring the Eagle Saloon, so it stands shuttered to this day. But on New Year's Eve 2012, we got Little Gem reopened with an amazing renovation. I mean, stunning, laser straight, two-story, gorgeous renovation. And we realized that night, as we were digging through all of the memorabilia, that Louis Armstrong, as a 12-year-old, was arrested that same night, 100 years ago to that night, outside the club, for firing a pistol off at midnight on New Year's Eve. And they put him into an orphanage where he learned to play the cornet. I thought that was funny.
The thing, I mean, you either love New Orleans or you hate it. I happen to love it. And one of the things I love is it's so quirky, its history is so quirky, and there's so damn much of it.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, now this next one, I think that I'm going to pass to you since you ended up doing the interview. I just want to say that the Monteleone Hotel staff was marvelous. And I can remember what I had for lunch. I couldn't remember what you had. I had the most marvelous TN of blue crab, which was in season, with avocado and Gulf shrimp. And then I had the wonderful chef special chicken paillette, which was really fabulous.
I've forgotten what I had, but I remember it was great.
It was good. But they were just so nice to me because I had this unfortunate lower back spasm out of the blue and was in tears, which certainly upset the waiter. But then they gave me a very dry Grey Goose martini with a dirty martini.
And it was better.
And it was helping.
The world was a better place. It's interesting. The Monteleone is a very splendid 600-room hotel. It has a really fine restaurant that's just been lavishly restored called Restaurant Crelo. And a bar that's been done up again as well with a great bartender. And we met several people from the hotel, but I said, I'd like to interview somebody about the hotel. And they said, well, the guy you have to talk to is Raoul. I didn't even say the history. I just said, I want to capture the spirit of the Monteleone Hotel. And they said, you have to talk to Raoul because Raoul has been a bellman here for 50 years. So it's very rare that a gentleman like this would get the spotlight.
And he's still working.
But you have to listen to the whole story. You didn't listen to the whole story. He said he couldn't possibly retire because he didn't know what he would do. So representing the Monteleone Hotel is Raoul Vavez, 50-year bellman. We're in the French Quarter of New Orleans, and it seems like half the world is here exploring this iconic part of a very un-American city. And I have the opportunity to talk to someone who's been working here in the quarter, having grown up in the quarter, for 50 years. Raoul Vives is a bellman, but he's a very important bellman because he's been with the Hotel Monteleone, which is where we are right now, for such a long time. Tell us first of all, Raoul, how did this place get its start?
It started as the Monteleone Hotel in 1886, Antonio Monteleone came in from Sicily. When he first came to New Orleans, he was a shoemaker. He had a shoe repair shop just across the street from the hotel, and then he later acquired one building and one from another to another to another. But he also made furniture in his shop, where this beautiful grandfather's clock in the lobby was made in his shoe shop. And the shop where he was on the corner of the hotel, and you can still see there's a mosaic tile in the doorway of the Monteleone crest, but that's where he got his start.
Now, it didn't look anything like this back in 1880-something, did it?
Oh, it's had so many changes since that when he started it. He tore one building down and rebuilt another one next to it, and now we have three buildings, and they all connect. We have 600 rooms, and we're right in the heart of the French Quarter with a real nice view of the mighty Mississippi. We also have a pool on the roof and a fitness center.
But one important thing hasn't changed over all these years. The family that founded the hotel still runs it. Why do you think they've been able to keep it up for such a long time?
They've been so nice to us, the employees, and, you know, I couldn't think of ever working for anybody else, and that's why I'm still here all this time. And we've had so many employees that were here even longer than I am. When I first started working here, we had a manager, a credit manager. He was working here 68 years in this hotel.
And you told me just a few minutes ago, I said, Rao, aren't you thinking about retiring after 50 years? And you said?
No, what else would I do? I enjoy what I'm doing, meeting all the people that come in this hotel, and they tell me how much they love it and all it is. And I'm always telling them where to go to eat and things like that. And they come back and they thank me and everything. And they just keep coming back year after year and just, you know, looking for me, telling me hi.
This is really an amazing thing because we met your executive chef. We met the chef in charge of the Criollo restaurant where we had lunch the other day, which was absolutely delightful. We met the food and beverage manager. We met all kinds of different people. But they said, the guy you need to talk to is Raul. How does that make you feel?
It makes me feel great because, you know, like I'm telling you, the guests that keep coming back year after year after year, and, you know, they tell their friends about it, and their friends come in here, and they'll tell me so-and-so was telling me, you know, to stay here, and they love it and everything. That's why one of the reasons why I'm still working here. I enjoy what I'm doing, you know, because we really give them, you know, like Southern hospitality. I can remember back in the years when the ladies used to wear dresses and hats. I don't see that no more. it's a little different, though. But they all love New Orleans, and, you know, for the things around here to see is just fantastic.
If somebody's planning to come to New Orleans, obviously we now know where they're going to stay. But how many days is a good number of days for people to spend so they can go all the places you're going to be able to tell them about?
I guess it would be about 4 or 5 days, and you know they can see. The first thing they should do is take a tour of the city. And that takes them through the French Quarter, the Garden District, takes them all over, tells you about the history of New Orleans and things like that. Do a city tour. We have other tours that they can take also, but the city tours are basically the best thing that they can do. They also have riverboat tours, their swamp tours, you name it, you know, cemetery tours, but we have a lot here to see. The history of this French Quarter is just, you just can't believe it if you see this city.
The city itself has had some real adventures over the years, most recently one associated with a weather system called Katrina. That must have been a tough time, but since then, everything's back to where it used to be?
Since Katrina, some parts of the city haven't really come back, and during Hurricane Katrina, the Monteleone family let all the employees stay in the hotel with their children, their pets, the whole nine yards, which was just fantastic. I mean, he fed us, did everything, you know, to really help us out. But parts of the city still haven't come back, like the lower Ninth Ward where I was living in Lakeview, and it's coming back. But the French Quarter is fine. We were the highest part of the city. We were right at sea level. We didn't flood or anything like that. The hotel was very old, but we had very, very little damage. We had very few windows blown in. We didn't have any water. We were very, very lucky.
I expect that had something to do with the fact that the Monteleone family built to last and invested for this to be something that would pass from generation to generation to generation. Am I right?
You are correct. It's now the fifth generation, and David Monteleone and his sister Ann and his sister-in-law, they have the hotel now, so they've taken it. It's the fifth.
And there's another generation coming, no doubt?
Yes, they also have their children, which are next in line, and believe me, they're going to do it.
It's just a wonderful thing. Now nothing stops, though, in the hotel business. You have to keep on improving things as you go along, and a major improvement that we noticed since the last time we were here, which is about 3 years ago, you've done a complete renovation of the bar area and also the restaurant.
Yeah, they spent a lot of money in a bar and a restaurant. So they added windows to the street, which they've never had. People coming by can actually look into the bar here and that and see all the entertainment in here, which is just fantastic. Before that, we didn't have the windows and people couldn't see in and they didn't know about it in here, but it's so nice now.
Well, everybody seems to know about it. You said there are 600 rooms. And you're full?
We are full. 600 rooms just about every night. We're sold out. So what else can we do?
Well, one thing we better do is we better record the website through which people can explore whether or not there's a reservation available. So tell us what that is, Raul.
Yeah, the website they can look at is hotelmonteleone.com.
And maybe you better, for those who are not fluent in Sicilian or Italian, you better spell that out.
All right, that's Monteleone, spelled Monteleone.
And the restaurant in the hotel, in case people actually can't find a room, they should still be encouraged to come here. If they like a very noisy bar, there's a very noisy bar, but there's also a very calm, quiet restaurant.
Correct. The restaurant's called Criollo, and the bar is the Carousel Bar, and we have one of the best bartenders in the city here, in Marvelous Marvin.
And what's Marvelous Marvin's favorite cocktail?
He likes the Bloody Bulls. That's his favorite drink.
Okay, Raul says he doesn't know what's in it. I guess he doesn't drink at all, but if he did, he'd probably do it somewhere else. Okay, well, it's been just a pleasure to talk to you, and I hope, listeners, that you plan your trip to New Orleans sufficiently in advance that you're going to be able to find a place, a room to stay in this hotel, and that when you get here, among the first calls you'll make is to find Raul and get Raul's suggestions as to where to go and where to dine outside the hotel if people have an appetite to do that. There are some famous places here in the Quarter. What are some of your favorites?
I guess one of my favorite restaurants is Napoleon House. It's an old bar, and there's a cupola on top of the bar, and it was originally there that they would station somebody up there to see when Napoleon's ship would arrive in New Orleans. That's why they call it the Napoleon House. But Napoleon died before his ship got here. But they still call it the Napoleon House, and they make this great sandwich called a muffalata. Nobody makes one any better in the world.
And I'm glad you told me that, because I've walked by the Napoleon House any number of times, and I've always wondered if it was safe to go inside. It's showing where that the Monteleone Hotel certainly isn't showing, right?
No, if you go there, you got to stop in there and go get yourself a muffalata. Don't go to Central Grocery and get one.
Okay, now, are any members of your family continuing on in your profession?
No, no one's continuing on in my profession. I have no one but me and my wife, and I have one middle-aged daughter. She's 33.
Hey, listeners, maybe she's looking for a husband.
No, she's married now. She lives in Waco, Texas. 7 years married and no children. So my wife and I are wondering what's going on.
Well, if you're like Peter and Ann from On the Menu, when you get grandchildren, you'll adore them. And so we wish that good fortune to you. We wish you good fortune for your continued career here at the Monteleone Hotel. And we really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us this morning.
Well, I thank you very much, Mr. Hagen. thank you for letting me really talk a little bit about the hotel, and I really appreciate it.
And I would have talked to Raoul a lot longer, except that he had to go take care of some guests.
We always have such a good time in New Orleans.
That's a good way to end up today's program. We're so glad you joined us. We have an intriguing ancient and modern, restaurant story for you next week.
Ancient's a bit of a stretch.
Okay, well, 174 years is pretty ancient as a restaurant, and one that's been open a few weeks is pretty modern. So you'll have to be sure to tune in next week for more of our epic visit to New Orleans. And in the meantime, between now and then, have a great time and do lots of good eating and drinking. And until then,
bye-bye.